Good morning.
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 Well, 10th century China saw a number of upheavals and rebellions. There were many, many years of widespread fighting, pillaging, sort of general destruction. This was not an easy time in which to be in China. A lot of warfare. So there was a Buddhist monk and poet named Qi Zhi, who lived from 864 to 937. He lived through this time. And there were several rebellions and several uprisings. So this happened in cycles over and over and over and over throughout this period of medieval China. So this poet, Qi Zhi, lived right at the end of the Tang Dynasty. So he was sort of in the middle of the last rebellion that eventually led to overthrowing this dynasty. So here he is. He, having lived through this, living in the middle of this, he wrote this poem called After the Rebellion, Visiting West Mountain Temple. Pines charred, temple wrecked all from the fighting, valleys transformed, ridges shifted, unbelievable events. Among clouds, I suddenly meet the new head priest. On the rocks, I spy inscriptions from earlier visits. Idly, I sit peering in a ruined pond where lotuses bloomed, pick my way over broken tiles of a once neatly patterned walk. I hope to join these fine monks in mending ties. I, for one, have no plans to abandon the road I'm on. This poem is about change. And this is uncomfortable change. Probably this West Mountain Temple had been pretty nice. It may actually have been on Aimeishan, which is sort of the Western Buddhist mountain. In Chinese Buddhist thinking, there is a mountain for each direction, a west, a north, east, south mountain. Each of these mountains is inhabited by one bodhisattva. So the Western mountain was inhabited by or dedicated to Samantabhadra, bodhisattva of creativity. In our meal chant, you know, we chant all these bodhisattvas. So this mountain is sacred to the bodhisattva of benevolent action, or great activity. So I'm extrapolating that Western mountain temple, but it might be the case. So now, according to this poem, the trees around this mountain are all burned down, or blackened, or charred. The temple building itself is destroyed. You know, it's wrecked. He says even the valleys and ridges are not the same after all the fighting that's going on. The armies that have come through and the destruction that's happened. So he calls these unbelievable events. Unbelievable events, he calls them. Fighting so widespread, so devastating, he can hardly get his mind around it. You know? And he's standing here in the midst of this physical aftermath. So he can't deny that this has happened. Clearly something's happened. He's, you know, in the middle of this wreckage. So it's quite tangible for him. It's quite real for him. It's all around him. So this is his experience of arriving at this temple, or being at this temple, that perhaps he once knew quite well, and looking around and seeing this sort of devastation. Among clouds, I suddenly meet the new head priest. So who knows what's happened to the old head priest? Has he died? Has he been killed? Has he fled? Has he been, perhaps, returned to lay life? This is a time of persecution of Buddhism in China. A number of temples, something like 4,600 temples, were closed. The monks and the nuns were forced to return to lay life. So who knows what's happened to the old head priest? Because now there's a new one. So it might have been a friend. The old head priest might have been a friend of Qi Zhi. It might have been at least someone he knew, or probably somebody that he knew. So this too has changed. On any other day, he might expect to see the old head priest kind of emerging from the mist. But he looks up and says, oh, this is a stranger. This is someone I don't know. But suddenly, here's somebody else. In the midst of all of this, the poet sees the inscriptions on the rocks from times when he's been here before. So either he's been here before and perhaps helped to create them, or maybe he and the old head priest looked them over, talked about them. Who knows? Moves on to look at the lotus pond, although now all the flowers have died. Maybe there isn't even any water in the pond anymore. This pond is a ruined lotus pond. And we know the symbol of the lotus, you know, the lotus has its roots in the mud, but somehow still it blooms on top of the water, just like our lives have roots in the mud, if you will, of this samsaric world, and yet Buddha nature is still there. Something is still blooming. This symbolism, this symbol has become quite thoroughly Buddhist, but it's older than Buddhism. It goes back to Hinduism. This is a very old symbol.
What's that symbol? The lotus?
The lotus.
The lotus? Oh.
It had similar roots in Hindu practice, you know. And when Buddhism arose in this Hindu container, this symbol was also became part of Buddhist practice. So this is important for us, this ruined pond, you know. At one point, there were lotuses there blooming with their roots in the mud and their faces, you know, on top of the water. So this too is gone. So finally, this poet picks his way over the broken tiles of the once neatly patterned walk. So even the paving stones have been torn up and broken by all of this fighting. So altogether, it seems like practice in this place has completely ground to a halt. There's a lot of mud, but there aren't any lotuses blooming. The tiles on this walkway are broken, so the way, the path, is not clear anymore. The daily schedule is probably gone. The artifacts that support practice are probably gone. The old head priest is gone. Even the building is gone. And yet, this is a poem about hope. I think. This is a poem about hope. Amidst all of this destruction, what remains? Still there are the inscriptions on the rocks. Likely, what's inscribed there are sutras, or at least some kind of canonical text. China has a long, long history of inscribing sutras on stone. We don't know what form these take. Sutras on stone could be caves. There were actually some temples in caves, but even if that isn't the case, there is a long history of inscribing stones with sacred writing. So it might be something quite small around the temple, or it might be something quite large. We don't know from this. But somehow that's still there. The Dharma written on these rocks is still there. Rocks are still expounding Dharma. Among clouds, I suddenly meet the new head priest. In Tang poetry, Tang Chinese poetry, the clouds can represent the Sangha. If we look at the word that sometimes, a term sometimes used for monks or for novice monks, it literally translates clouds and water, because these are people who now don't light anywhere. They blow and flow, you know, as the circumstances arise. So they go, or they flow, depending on causes and conditions. They don't stick anywhere. They come and go. So among the monks, among the clouds, among the monks, I suddenly meet their new leader. I suddenly meet their new head priest. And so the second to last line of the poem says, I hope to join these fine monks in mending ties. Not I hope to join these fine monks in rebuilding the temple, or I hope to join these fine monks in sitting zazen. I hope to join these fine monks in rebuilding ties. Why? Because rebellion is about broken relationships, right? It's about people choosing sides, going to war against each other, having conflict with each other. So Qijie is living at the end of the Tang Dynasty, as I say, when the imperial government was really persecuting Buddhism. It was seen as a threatening force. It was foreign, because it was Indian, right? It didn't arise in China, like Taoism and Confucianism, which were native to China. Buddhism was an import. So Buddhism was foreign. And although up to this point it had flourished quite happily, thinking changes. The temples became quite powerful. They started to own a lot of land. They started to have a lot of money. They started to have a lot of influence. Government feels threatened. So it starts to, as I say, close temples, force ordained folks to return to lay life. Confucianism, Taoism are seen as friendly, not threatening, they're native. So Buddhism's having a hard time, and I'm guessing that the imperial armies didn't shed too many tears if in the course of overrunning somewhere to put down the rebellion, a few Buddhist temples got destroyed. You know, probably they weren't too concerned about it. Maybe it was a nice little benefit for them. Let's get rid of a few more Buddhists while we're at it. I don't know, but it could be. So, even perhaps the people who, the lay people, the village people, or the just the people who lived around, who maybe had been part of this temple, maybe had practiced here, maybe supported the temple. We can imagine they were probably too fearful to do much about protecting this temple. You know, if a rampaging army is coming through your town, probably you're afraid for your life, at least for your crops and your house and everything else. The last thing you're probably thinking about is, oh my gosh, they're going to destroy the Buddhist temple. So I'm guessing, you know, these temples got ruined, and there wasn't a whole lot that anybody could really do about it. You know, it's just a tough time for Buddhism. So after this rebellion, Chiju is wandering around this ruined, wrecked temple. It's the aftermath of the fighting. And he's resolving to work with the monks here to rebuild relationships. So that could be relationships with the local people. It could be relationships with the government. It could be relationships with the rebels. They're trying to overthrow the government. It could be relationships with each other, because the monks who had been there could have been scattered, could have been driven off, returned to lay life. Again, many, many lost relationships. So he's wandering through this temple, sort of bearing in mind all of these lost relationships. Things that are broken, things that are lost. So Chija ends his poem by saying, I, for one, have no plans to abandon the road I'm on. So in spite of all of this, he's not giving up his practice. This is a tough, challenging place and a tough, challenging time, and he's resolving not to give up his practice. If anything, it's probably even more important to him now in the aftermath of this rebellion, because everything's up in the air. So, you know, this is a practice of fine-tuning, coming back, over and over. As I tell the folks when they come to intro Zazen, you know, this is very much a practice of fine-tuning. Fine-tuning the posture, you know, we know the mind kind of wanders away, we grab it, we bring it back. It's this constant coming back, coming back, coming back. So here we see this poem. This temple gets knocked down, walkway gets torn up, well, this pond is drained. What do? We take a breath, and we get started on the cleanup. Because what else can we do? How can we do this and not become discouraged? I think we let go of two things. We let go of the attachment to the way things used to be, and we let go of the idea that there is anything outside of this moment. So West Mountain Temple may have had a long, long history. We don't know when it was built or anything about it, but it might have been there for quite a long time. So it might have quite a deep history. Things may have been done there a certain way for a long time. You know, things might have been in a certain place. Practice might have been done in a certain way for many, many, many years. And now the monks have to reestablish their practice according to new conditions. Everything's changed. So somehow they have to keep going. They have to reestablish their practice. They've got a new leader. Maybe some of them have left. Maybe new folks have arrived. A whole new sangha. We don't know. They don't certainly don't have all the resources they had before. If the forest is burned, you know, the buildings are knocked over, things are probably missing. They certainly don't have all the resources that they had. We can imagine that the temple is destroyed, looting has happened. So probably any kind of valuable artifacts, any statues they had, any money they had is probably long gone. So they don't have everything they had before. This is a whole new day. So to have any attachment to the way things used to be is simply to set ourselves up for suffering. Right? That time is gone. So here on Sumantrabhadra's mountain, Chiju is pledging to take action, to band together with the monks, with the other monks, with the rest of his sangha, and to keep practicing, to stay on this path. So, you know, this is a new moment. And the only place we can practice is this moment. We can't change the past. That would be nice. We can't change the fact that the rampaging armies have come through. We can't change that. We don't know about the future. We can plan for it. We can have an idea about it. You know, it's good to not ignore it. But we don't really know. We can't practice there. We can't practice back here. Right here is all we got. So this is the only moment in which we can practice. We have to let go of past, let go of future. Come back to this moment and get on with it. Right? We can't get stuck. We've got to just get on with it. So, you know, sometimes practice is not easy. We know practice is not easy, but this poet says, I, for one, have no plans to abandon the road I'm on. So we can perceive that there are obstacles in the road. We can perceive that there are obstacles in the road. Are they there? But often we perceive them, you know. But if we're seeing clearly, we see the true nature of the obstacles. We see clearly where they come from. How did they get there? What are they really? Right? We can only do that if we're sitting and practicing and having some wisdom, cultivating some wisdom, cultivating some insight. In the aftermath of an argument or a disappointment, it's really hard to stay right here. We can spend a lot of time justifying how things happened, you know, what I did. I was right and he was wrong, and so, you know, it all happened because of somebody else. It's not my fault. Things turned out this way. Well, you know, that's not being right here. Sometimes it's useful to go back and think about what happened because we can learn something from that. But we have to do that skillfully. Not because we're trying to make ourselves okay or because we're trying to justify what happened. You know, that's the time to open the hand and say, you know, it's water under the bridge. I will be more skillful next time based perhaps on what I learned from this experience, but I can't stay there because all I've got is this moment. But sometimes, you know, we'll replay the past over and over and over. Or we'll worry about the future. We'll write a lot of stories about what's going to happen in the future. Well, we don't know. We're not living right here. We're living, you know, somewhere else. Of course it's good to plan. If, you know, we need to plan, it's good to have a plan. But then, you know, you get on with it. We can't live by writing a lot of stories about the future. Those are just our ideas, this past and this future. So we have to look quite carefully at what's in front of us right now. There may well be opportunities we miss because we're married to our preconceptions, or we're so worried about what happened before or what's going to happen next. We miss opportunities that might be developing right in front of us. So in the aftermath of disaster, when everything is destroyed, what can we build out of the pieces? When we look carefully at what's in front of us, you know, what do we do with that? What can we do with that? This rebuilding is a creative process, and it's a process that requires complete non-attachment, because it's really the same spirit of inquiry that we bring to our Zazen. What's really here? What's really happening? What's really arising? You know, what's the real opportunity? It's the same kind of open-heartedness. Open-spiritedness, spirit of inquiry.